cutting through an overload of information to get to the heart of the story. This is The Point.
Welcome to a special edition of The Point with me, Liu Xin, coming to you from Mount Uyi in southern China's Fujian province. Socialism with Chinese characteristics, democracy with Chinese characteristics, and modernization with Chinese characteristics. It seems that every time we talk about China, it has to have some Chinese characteristics. But exactly what does this term mean? It may sound obscure, but for the Chinese, it's not obscure at all. So to help us understand these concepts, I'm here joined by Professor Roland Boer from the School of Philosophy of Renmin University of China, and we're in Uyi Academy, the place where an ancient Chinese scholar helped shape the Chinese civilization. Roland, welcome to The Point, and let's discuss this thing that everybody or people hear so much about, but they don't really understand exactly what it is, which is the Chinese characteristics. We hear so often, what make up the Chinese characteristics? And if I would ask you to use three keywords, what would you choose?
Three words: concrete conditions and culture.
Tell us a bit more. What do you mean by concrete conditions?
Well, when I translate it normally, I don't actually use socialism with Chinese characteristics. Or I'll explain it by saying, well, that is socialism in light of China's practical realities, concrete conditions, its history, development, all those kinds of things, the economic stage that it's at. And this applies because these things influence the way in which, you know, socialism or democracy or so on develops in a particular context. So that's what it means. It's that reality, the history, the culture, all those sorts of things.
Would you bring one element, a concrete example of the concrete conditions that you mentioned?
I was thinking actually of a very, you know, concrete reality. In 1949, with the establishment of the new China, China was one of the poorest countries in the world.
Yeah.
By a long way. Life expectancy was something like 35, 36. What does that concrete condition mean? Well, you need to focus on the basic realities of life. You can't sort of talk about all sorts of other things before you actually have those fundamental things in place. That's a very, very concrete everyday life economic position, and you need to develop things in light of that context.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of concrete conditions I was referring to.
What about the cultural aspect? Because the third C is culture.
That's
what about the Chinese culture that made the Chinese people back then susceptible or can relate to the ideas that were introduced through Marxism, through the party of communism?
Well, I'm touching in on a huge discussion in China currently. It's known, sort of, the term is the second integration, and that is the integration of the basic principles of Marxism with the best of, as how I translate it, traditional Chinese culture. Now, what does that mean in light of the cultural framework? On the one hand, this has always been underway. There's a reason why Marxism took root.
Yes.
Very practical realities, but also some core values that had grown up over the millennia of civilization. It's a process of constant renewal, innovation, that's already built into the Chinese cultural assumption. It's not regressive, it doesn't go look back to the past, hang on to the past for the sake of the past, but it uses the values of the past to develop in a new way.
And again, this is not how everyday China looks. If you go out on the street, you know, it looks like very much a Western city. So where are we going? I mean, and then hence the importance maybe to rediscover who we are and to revitalize the traditional roots of us. Do you think that is what's happening?
I see that happening. In a sense, it's been implicit, but it's become very explicit in the process that's been taking place. There's another important dimension of this, though, and you find, for example, I've been in May this year, or last year, I went to Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very notable that culture flourishes, innovations, both carrying forward the traditional culture, the best of it, but also innovations in culture in a new way, really takes place best on a strong economic foundation. And when you've got the resources to do so, you can, all of these things can be fostered and encouraged and so on.
Yeah.
And China has that economic foundation now, and it's able to do it. At the same time, there's a recognition, I think, as the saying goes, where would China be today without 5,000 years of civilization? It wouldn't be China without that. So understanding it all the way from, if you like, before, you know, say from Confucius to today, understanding that history, understanding that culture, criticizing what's now outdated and shouldn't be taken forward, but drawing out what is valuable and taking it forward. That's really vital.
How important is it, though, to understand this, to understand what makes the Chinese Chinese? How important is it, especially for people around the world this day and age? Because there is a great competition going on. There is hostilities, rivalry going on. And the constant, I would say, accusation of the bad intentions of China or of the risk that China poses. And on the other hand, China says, we don't want, you know, to take over the world. What we want is a community of shared future for humankind. But people don't really relate to that idea, many. So why is it important to understand this?
Well, one thing is quite clear, and it's been noticeable in the last 5 or 10 years. China has stepped onto the center of the world stage. And a small example of this in Australia, they used maybe to have, when the two sessions, the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference were taking place, they might have one little report on it.
Yeah.
This year, they're reporting on each day.
Okay.
Now, the representation, of course, you know what to expect. It's negative, it's misinterpreted,
rubber stamp.
All this rubber stamp stuff and so on and so forth. But the fact that they're paying attention to it is a recognition that the decisions made are not just important in China, but have global implications.
Mm.
So it really is, you know, at the center of conversations, analysis, but also there's two sides to it. And I always say to people that the West is actually a small number of countries in the world, total population of the world about 12%. And what I find very interesting is that mostly, but not always, in Western countries, the world's changing, qualitative change is taking place, and they're very unsettled.
Yeah.
Very unsettled. They know things are changing. The world that they knew is past or passing.
Yeah.
There's a new world emerging. They don't understand it, but they need to understand it. So there's a tension, there's efforts to denigrate it. And of course, the other thing is, there's a good old saying, my parents were from the Netherlands. And there's a saying in the Netherlands, but also in Denmark, a thief always thinks everyone else is a thief.
Okay. I know, yeah. Well, some people may be offended by that statement, right?
So, yes, to a good point. What I'm trying to say is that the problem with the countries that, or the leadership of the media that is trying to misrepresent China or even fabricate lies about it, is that they assume that China is the same as they are. For those, either they understand but don't want to admit it,
mm-hmm.
or they simply don't understand that there's a different, very different way of approaching engagements with the world.
Yeah.
One example is that some people talk about a new Cold War.
Yes.
But you need two to play the game.
Okay.
And if you have one who wants to foster a Cold War, but the other side is simply not playing the game.
You don't think China is...
not playing the game.
Why not? Why do you not think so?
Well, in response, for example, to US sanctions, what does China do? It opens up further. And instead of engaging in bloc mentality, the Belt and Road includes more and more countries around the world in an inclusive approach to work with them.
But you see, the argument among many the Western countries now is China is trying to build its sphere of influence so that it has many brothers and sisters and allies in disguise so that it will take over the world, or the Chinese model may take over the world. And you don't think that is China's intention?
Absolutely not.
From the cultural perspective, why do you think it is? Or maybe the traditional culture has changed over the past 40 years with the onslaught of Western ideas, Western notions?
It could be, but I don't think that's the case. There's another factor that's actually very, very important here, and this resonates with many countries around the world, and it's China's experience during the century of humiliation, so from roughly the Opium Wars in the 1850s to 1949, is semi-colonialism, invasion by imperialist powers, and really ground into the dust. And so the principle arose of mutual non-interference, or, if you like, the negative is not seeking hegemony, not seeking to dominate. Mm-hmm. And this is a fundamental principle when engaging with other countries. And which countries recognise that principle? Countries that have been colonised in the past by Western imperial powers, because they have exactly the same approach. We don't want you to tell us what to do, and we won't tell you what you should do. And it's that experience where you find... And if you think about all the countries in the world that have been colonised, it's the majority. So in a sense, it's quite clear, and it's been emphasised right through and again recently by the foreign minister, that China's relationship with developing countries, or the global south, if we want to use those terms, is always much closer because it comes out of a common historical experience.
To have been colonised.
Exactly.
Have been near being dismembered. At a certain point.
Yeah.
But do you think that China could change, or China could have adopted some of other notions?
The change is perhaps not in terms of trying to dominate or take over in that respect. It's simply not part of the, if you like, the Chinese cultural DNA, as from my perspective. Mm-hmm. It's simply not there. But what has changed is the need to develop mechanisms for engaging globally. As I said, China stepped onto the centre of the world stage. Every decision now made, every policy adopted, has implications obviously for China, but also has global implications.
Yeah.
And it's becoming used to that process, which it was already an anticipation 40, 45 years ago, but it's really become a reality in the last decade or so. So that is the notable development, how to deal with that, how to engage in that in a productive way. And so you find all of the policies being put forward on a new forms of global governance, new form of human civilization, a shared future for humankind, one after another, the Global Security Initiative. These are with a global view.
Our idea of how the world should be.
Oh, that's an interesting question. I see them more as putting forward proposals for people to consider and then consulting about them and developing.
That's precisely what some people are afraid of. They're saying, oh, China is big and stronger. Now it wants to reshape the world order. That's what some people are saying. Do you see it that way?
What world order are we talking about? Are we talking about...
They're ostensibly talking about the world order that's been established after Second World War,
right.
You know,
yeah.
The US-led institutions,
that's
the
right.
United... And China also says that we want to have the United Nations at the core, you know, we respect the UN Charter and so on. We don't want to throw out everything, the World Trade Organization, at least the institutions that China says we want to uphold it. So how do you reconcile the kind of visions that China has put forward, the three initiatives and the, you know, community of shared future, and the existing after post-World War II order?
Well, there's two sides to this, it seems. One is that the existing organisations are obviously going to be reformed in light of the changing global situation. But on the other hand, you have a series of other organisations now, Belt and Road, Shanghai Cooperation Organisation and so on, which are providing of structures that are getting more and more important, BRICS as well as part of it, structures that are by their very nature going to change the way in which the world operates. But this is not simply a desire of a country like China, it's a desire of countries like Russia, countries in Africa, etc. The so-called rules-based world order, as is pointed out, is actually what Washington tells you to do. I think it's great that it is a time of qualitative change and that the world order we've had is changing. I think that's for the better. There's risks, but it's also immense opportunities.
Yeah. In the end, if China does become a modernized country with Chinese characteristics, coming back to that term,
yeah.
How long do you think that's going to take? and what kind of world are we going to see?
2049.
2049? Okay. Okay, so we have 25 years.
It's the obviously that's the century since the founding of
China. You think it's doable? You think it's possible?
In some respects, things have already happened, but in another respect, it seems to me that China has only just begun. Or maybe I'll put it another way, because that can sound ominous to some listeners, if I put it that way. What I find the situation is, no matter how something good is or seems to be, they don't really sit back and say, oh, okay, it's achieved, don't need to do anything more. It can always be improved in some way, and it has to be because conditions change.
Yeah.
That's a reality. I find more and more students from many different countries want to come to China to study to find out what makes China tick.
Yeah.
What makes China tick, because this is a reality of the world today, but it's also a reality that China is on the world stage with other countries on the world stage. It's not the hegemon, to use that old term from, you know, the Warring States period and so on. That's the big difference.
Fascinating. We have to be patient. Yeah.
We do have to be patient, yes. We do have to be patient.
And meanwhile, do what we have to do to make this world a more equal place. And thank you so much, Roland, for sharing with us your thoughts and insights.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Roland Boer, professor from the School of Philosophy at Renmin University of China. I'm in Mount Uyi in southern China's Fujian province. It's mid-spring, the climate pleasant and the scenery beautiful. It's a special place for the Chinese, although many may not be aware of it. If you're going to understand today's China, it's a must-go. And for my next guest, a scholar from Austria specialized in ancient languages, this place sheds light on something he's been studying for decades. And we talked about food as well. Professor Fenner, welcome to The Point. This is a beautiful setting. We're in southern China's Fujian province, north of Fujian province, in this beautiful mountainside that's called Mount Uyi, where we have this beautiful creek that's running behind us. You are a scholar of linguistics, particularly Sanskrit, but of course you also touch upon Chinese philosophy. Mm-hmm. Give us your impression of the kind of inspiration that ancient Chinese languages or linguistics or philosophers may have drawn from this kind of geographical environment.
Yes, I think, and that's exactly what you feel here when you walk through this forest and when you hear the river and when you see the mountains.
When you hear the bird chirps.
And hear the birds, especially now in the spring. You can relate to the imagery of ancient China. You can relate to the texts. You can relate to exactly what is one thing that I'm interested in, into harmony in nature, but also in human relations.
Mm. Well, that's something we take it for granted. But for the Western culture or Europeans, when they hear the word harmony, what first comes to their mind?
Yeah, I think for Western culture and Western thinking, harmony is usually associated with music. And there is this long tradition where basically it only means things in music, and it means basically kind of a unity, but a unity without difference, right?
Mm.
And I think the major difference to the Chinese understanding of harmony is that harmony is unity in diversity. So that different things, different ingredients, different relations come and integrate into a unity, and that they have different trajectories, different natures, which is not exclusive, but contributes to this harmony. And I think there's a difference to the Western concept that's kind of more uniform.
Have you tried to find out why this harmony concept is so stressed, given the diversity? Is it because of the diversity that there is the stress on harmony?
I would say so, because the 5,000 years of Chinese culture, right from the beginning, it was a mixture of different cultural traditions coming from different areas of what's now China. coming from different populations and developing very dynamically over these 5,000 years, always with influence that was taken in from the outset, with influence that was projected to the outset. So I think that harmony is so central is exactly because Chinese culture is so diverse and has so many different sources from which it draws its power from.
Mm. In Chinese, the Chinese character that embodies the harmony concept would be he, would it be, right? Mm-hmm. And this word, it consists of one part, a sprout of a plant, yep. or grain, he, and the yep. other is a mouth,
yep.
right? How would you understand how this word came about?
Yeah, I mean, the etymology of the character and the etymology of the word, there are different ways of interpreting it. So there are two early interpretations, and the one is connected to music, and the other one is connected to food and also mixing and harmonizing of drinks in a way, which is nice. And we have one early commentary that I like very much, where it says that harmony is basically like making soup. Mm. You need to have different ingredients, and you have to look at the relations of the ingredients to make a very good soup. And I can very much relate to that, because I think one cultural similarity between China and Austria is kind of an obsession with good food.
Goulash.
Yeah,
the goulash. Okay. Yeah, in a way, we do have some very similar dishes there. But then people say, okay, don't we have that in Europe too?
Yeah, I think exactly the problem is that the concept of harmony in this broad philosophical sense and in this understanding of unity and diversity, you basically only have in a dialectical tradition, which was not and still not is not the dominant tradition. So you basically have a line of tradition that goes from Heraclitus via the early dialecticians like Aristotle down to Leibniz, or up to Leibniz, and then from Leibniz to Hegel, and from Hegel to Marx.
So basically, are you saying, because people hear so much something with Chinese characteristics, you know, democracy with Chinese characteristics, modernization with Chinese characteristics. Is that a very key element to understand when you try to understand what exactly Chinese characteristics?
Yeah, yes, I think it is. So harmony is a core tenet. But I would go even further. So harmony is not only a concept that would help the West to understand China better, so that the Chinese concept of harmony, but I think it would also be a concept that we in Europe could take over from China, or at least integrate it in our cultural tradition much stronger, in going back to our own tradition of harmony that I mentioned, namely the Leibniz and dialectical philosophy.
Why do you say that? Harmony.
Because I think what we are experiencing now in these globally difficult times is that Europe and the West generally is basically going against diversity. Against diversity in concerning economy, against cultural diversity. We have the rise of racism and nationalism in very ugly guises again. So I think this harmony as unity in diversity would be something that where we can learn from China, actually.
I would understand, though, there are fear that, for instance, because let's say the Chinese culture or Chinese products are so powerful, they're so competitive that if people embrace diversity, maybe it means that they fear it may mean that they're taken over, you know, mm-hmm. that their place in society, their importance may be replaced by a new concept, so they lost who they are. Have you ever thought about that? What is your answer?
Yeah, I think we have nothing to fear from China. We have to gain a lot by maintaining and advancing people-to-people relationships with China. And I think if we look now, especially in advanced technology, China is leading. And what is Europe doing? Europe is not trying to cooperate with China on this, but quite the opposite. But cooperation is vital because these key technologies that China is developing are key technologies that will help us prevent further deterioration of climate change, for example. So I think Europe has nothing to fear, but a lot of to gain. Western civilization has great achievements, but the last 500 years, the main political characteristic was imperialism and colonialism. And the end of this period started with the Russian Revolution, and now with China as the first major global power, non-Western global power, we're heading towards the end of this 500-year period of imperialism and colonialism, and I think that's a very, very good development.
In the end, what do you think is a perfect state of the world? Perfect picture of the world, of different civilizations?
Yeah, I would here directly come back to harmony, namely unity and diversity. I think there is one shared humankind, and we have one shared future ahead of us. That means that we have to integrate different perspectives to form one perspective of humanity. And I think this will only work if we talk on a par or the same level, and that there are no powers that can dictate other countries how they should live, how they should do their economy, what they should think. I think this diversity, this unity in diversity, that is a nice future for humanity. And I think China plays a very important role towards this path.
Thank you so much, Hans Fellner, professor of the University of Vienna of the Department of Linguistics.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Many thanks to Hans Fellner, professor at the Department of Linguistics in the University of Vienna. With that, we come to the end of this special edition of The Point with me, Liu Xin, coming to you from the beautiful Mount Uyi in southern China. As always, you can follow me on Facebook and Twitter using the handle Liu Xin in Beijing. You've got The Point.